So, good morning again, everyone. And Sharon, thank you, as always, for your music, as well as bringing Duncan. And all of you for being here today, and I hope the rest of the day, this gorgeous day, that you'll be able to appreciate it. Do any of you get a daily email from Heather Cox Richardson, Letters from an American? She lives in Maine, and I've been getting these letters for the last year and a half or so. Deborah mentioned it to me, and so I started subscribing. And she always has these really interesting insights about American culture, about politics, about religion, and about people in our history. And I think you might enjoy her work, Heather Cox Richardson. Letters from an American. And this morning she talked about Mother's Day, and in particular Julia Ward Howe, although she never mentioned that she was a Unitarian, so I was irritated about that. But it's a very good column and it comes out daily. I hope maybe you'll subscribe to it. Well, we know it is Mother's Day yet again, and it's a day that quite a number of people, myself included, tend to tiptoe around because of our relationships or our memories of motherhood can be somewhat complex. And of course, for many women who chose or were not able to have children biologically, you still, if you have children who were adopted, or people who you've cared for in your life as a parent, that also is mothering. But this morning, I'd like to explore three different types of Mother's Day. Two of them were formed in the 19th and early 20th century, and the third type speaks for itself and is actually the focus. So let's start first with Unitarian Julia Ward Howe. She was born in 1819 and lived until October of 1910. She was very much involved in the suffrage movement, but a lot of her passion was for the abolition movement before the Civil War. Her New England roots, and she lived in Rhode Island, gave her the independence and stubbornness and determination to help create a world freed from all slavery and also from war. This morning, all the women in the congregation read the Mother's Day Proclamation. And I used to think a long time ago that Julia Ward Howe had written that because of the Civil War in this country, since she wrote it right after the end of the Civil War and well after the time that she wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which has a certain different tone to it. I always thought the two were tied together, but when I read her autobiography, she said that she was primarily outraged not by just the Civil War in this country, but the Franco-Prussian War in the 1860s. It seemed to her that war was a return to the barbaric, in which her words could have otherwise been resolved by compromise and listening without the bloodshed and war that killed so many sons and daughters and husbands. Her outrage was so profound that she wrote the proclamation in the hopes that women the world over would respond with massive protest. Well, it wasn't yet the opportunity to reach a critical mass. First of all, we didn't have the internet at the time, so rapid communications were not possible. And being able to include and empower women in community was a slow and fitful process, especially when the suffrage movement was dealing with men who somewhat disagreed that women should vote. And I'd mentioned earlier that Julia Ward Howe was a Unitarian, and this is many years, a century before Unitarian Universalism joined into what we know now as Unitarian Universalism. She was a longtime member of the Channing Unitarian Church in Newport, Rhode Island. Her family, her life and her marriage were not happy. She struggled with illness and depression much of her life. She wrote poetry, but is still best known for the Battle Hymn of the Republic and, in a lesser way, the Mother's Day Proclamation. She was, however, the first woman to be elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 1908. Now, a lot of people don't realize, and I was one of them, don't realize that there was another effort to create an official Mother's Day in the 19th century. Anna Jarvis was from West Virginia, and she had helped to found Mother's Day work clubs during the Civil War to treat and support soldiers from both sides of the conflict. She later began a Mother's Friendship Day to bring people from both sides of the Civil War together. She was very close to her own mother, and later in her life, when her mother died, she decided to start a campaign to make Mother's Day an official American holiday. Finally, after many years, she succeeded, and in 1914, Mother's Day became an official holiday. Later on, as we heard earlier, she became horrified with the commercialization of Mother's Day. She was really embittered that so many people would simply send their mother a greeting card, and that was it. And I'll repeat the words I used in the opening words. A printed card means nothing, except that you are too lazy to write to the woman who's done more for you than anyone in the world. And candy! You take a box to mother, and then you eat most of it yourself. She didn't like that idea. Her life wasn't easy either. Her efforts to hold on to the original meaning of the day led to her own economic hardship. She did not get any of the royalties or profits for the commercialization of Mother's Day, and her life was very, very hard as a result. She spent the later years of her life with her sister Lily, never had children. And in 1943, because she was still really upset about the whole thing, she began organizing a petition to get rid of Mother's Day entirely. However, these efforts were halted when she was placed in the Marshall Square Sanitarium in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Now, a sanitarium was not a place for the mentally ill. It was a place for long-term care for people who were in a terminal illness. And I'm not sure what illnesses she had, but she was in very bad health. She stayed there until 1948, and people who were associated with the floral and greeting card industries paid the bills to pay for her care throughout those years. So I've mentioned so far two forms of Mother's Day. What's the third one? Mother Nature, or Mother Earth, is an expression I'm sure all of us know. Some of us began a book discussion group this spring using the book Finding the Mother Tree by Dr. Suzanne Simard. The title is important because Dr. Simard is a forest ecologist on the faculty of the University of British Columbia. She worked for timber companies as a student, and those of us who are in the class will remember that she wondered why, and she was a student, why the plants, the trees, the saplings that the timber companies were replanting in these huge clear-cut areas, why they weren't living very long. They were ill, they were sickly, and they would die. She learned from her own investigations and from native peoples that the trees naturally support each other using fungi and root systems to connect and in some ways communicate. Dr. Simard identified something called a hub tree or mother tree. Mother trees, she said, are the largest trees in forests that act as central hubs for vast below-ground fungi networks. A mother tree, she said, supports seedlings by infecting them with fungi and supplying them with the nutrients they need to grow. And it's a two-way process. She said later in her book that Mother Nature is like those mother trees. Everything is interconnected. And we say this in our seventh principle, which reminds us that we have respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Note, it doesn't say a part rather than a part. We're not apart from nature. We're not apart from the interconnected web of all existence. We are deeply part of it. It affects us, and we affect it. And we know from the contemporary news that what we call Mother Nature is in trouble. Species are going extinct. Warming temperatures around the world are creating more dramatic weather and climate changes, and we know this. Huge wildfires right now are burning in New Mexico, where my family was from. It is tempting, and I'm tempted sometimes, to just throw up our hands in despair and give up. It is so tempting because the issue is so large, it's global, and there seems to be no harmonized or organized way to respond to it from the powers that be. So this Mother's Day, given some of the issues that people have with their mothers or motherhood in general, I'm suggesting a different option. Oftentimes, our congregations do a flower communion or flower celebration on Mother's Day. People bring flowers in and they're set out, and then people come up after the service and take a different flower that was brought and they take it home, and that's a form of communion for Unitarian Universalism. So I decided, well, let's try something different today. What I would like us to do is, you see these plants right in front of you here. There are outdoor plants, they are violets, am I correct? What are those? What's that? The violets are indoor, thank you, and they are in front. And they are kind of purplish?
Yeah.
Okay. Peggy and Deb were the ones who got them, and I'm not a person who knows plants very well. Because if I get near a plant or I buy one, it simply goes, and that's it. So, and there may be some other people who have that particular issue about plants, but there are outdoor plants and there are indoor plants. I would invite anyone who wishes to take one home to come up during the postlude when Sharon is playing and just take one of the plants. If you want one to plant outside, they're all in the back. If you want to have one for inside your home, then take one of the ones in front. And if you're like me, no way am I going to take a live plant because it will have a short lifetime, you can take one of the plant, the flowers here in the vase behind the plants. So why am I suggesting this? It all could just be empty symbolism. But I think it's the small things that help us keep going and keep facing the uncertainties of the future. And here I'm talking about the climate crisis. It's easy to despair. It's easy to say, how are we going to solve the whole problem? It's beyond our power. And that is true. But it's not beyond our power to make these small, significant, important changes, like growing a plant that will take in carbon dioxide and let out oxygen. One last story. When I arrived here in the late summer of 2019, and my goodness, does that sound like a long time ago, I told the story of a child and starfish, and you probably have all heard this story before, but I'll repeat it. It's a well-known story, and the story goes, and there are several variations. Somebody's walking by a beach, and there's been a storm, and the waves washed up countless starfish that are dying on the beach. A child, sometimes a girl and sometimes a boy, is on the beach picking up starfish one at a time to throw back into the ocean. The adult goes over to the child and says, "You can't possibly save all of them." And the child responds, "Maybe not, but I can save this one," and throws it back into the ocean. Now, in some versions of the story, the adult just shakes their head and walks away. In other versions, the adult joins the child, picking up starfish and taking them back to the water. In yet other versions, the ending is that other people notice this as they're walking, and they all start picking up the starfish to put them back in the ocean. Was that child a mother in caring for other sentient beings, the starfish? Was the adult who might have helped them a mother? Would that mean that saving a life, not just saving a life, but seeing that a life must be saved or must be grown or whatever it may be, is maybe a larger, broader, universal understanding of what motherhood actually can be at its best. So when we have the postlude and you come up to take a plant home and to plant it either inside or outside and to take care of it, that is part of joining in our own small, maybe insignificant way, to begin in our spot here to help heal the world.